This is the Outrider Podcast. Thing is that, you know, this actually is kind of an extension of what we've been talking about the whole time, you know, resistance and where we've kind of gone with it, you know, through meditation and then some of our other discussions is this idea of community, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to tell your bookstore story, or do you want to, you know, go somewhere else?
I feel like you know, I've just found out about a couple of reading series that are here.
Uh-huh.
So there are some of those happening. In fact, a poet I like very much, Joel Brower, read here, I think on Thursday, but I didn't see any notice of it or anything. And maybe that was my fault until, I mean, I saw it Thursday morning was the first, or Thursday morning or Wednesday night, something like that was the first I saw of it. So I really wasn't able to go. But there is a reading, kind of a public reading series going on. And I guess with that, maybe I need to do better, look at what some of the universities, it's just, and maybe I'm not tapped into the right places to find out about
right.
some of that. But there was, to briefly bring in the bookstore story, was that idea of community and meeting with people, and part of that, I don't know if I've talked about this on episodes. I know we did one on meditation, but that was before I started sitting with other people.
Right.
So this summer I started sitting with other people, and that's been a pretty powerful thing. And my interest was to extend that in terms of writing.
Mm-hmm.
And the bookstore story was really just, you know, asking about that. What are people doing? Are people reading together? Are there anything like that was going on? And I was at, you know, my local independent bookstore,
right.
and was told that there was just no time for any of that. No one does it. And maybe Goodreads would be a place to look at for it.
Yeah. That I was kind of shocked by that. You know, when you first told me the story, it was a bit longer and more detailed, but I thought, you know, you'd asked if they had like a newsletter or did book reviews or anything like that. And they were mm-hmm. like, no, we just let Goodreads handle it. And I thought to myself, that's the kind of the complete opposite of, you know, my local independent bookstore, which has.
It was not what I expected at all. And there was even a shelf in the back for reading groups. And mm-hmm. so I was kind of asking about that. Like, and they just said, oh, we tried that once and it didn't work.
Right.
And I don't know. I was taken aback by it. It definitely is the independent store with the best selection in the store,
right?
That I've been to. I don't know. I was baffled.
Do they do readings? Do they bring writers into?
They have at times, but it, you know, it's pretty limited who comes through Birmingham. I mean,
right?
I know they did in their old spot. They had recently moved,
right?
But, yeah, I don't know. I'm going to try to pay attention to some of that more. And it could be just that I don't see it or find it. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. 'Cause here at Watermark, you know, they've constantly bringing in writers. They have real close relationships with a lot of the publishers out there, and bring their writers in quite frequently. They'll have, you know, two or three events a week sometimes during a month, and it's just busy. I often feel bad that I can't get to all of them, but then again, I don't like all of the writers that show up.
Sure.
You know, but they have store sponsored book clubs, yeah. And then they have,
I was going to say there would be something wrong if you did anyway.
Yeah.
You know, hopefully they would be grabbing from a wide enough selection that, you know,
right. Cause
you wouldn't like all the writers. Yeah. I'm sorry.
No. So, you know, then they've got the sponsored book clubs that, store employee leads. And then they also supply books and space to book clubs that are doing their own thing. And just, you know, those clubs order books from the store and get a discount on the books. And they have a loose relationship with the MFA program at Wichita State, but it's, I say loose, it's more like a tenuous side-eye kind of relationship. You know, the store...
Why is that?
Well, I don't know.
It seems like they could bring together, you know, funding and stuff, and... But
yeah, I don't know why it is. You know,
I don't know how that works with the university either. Sometimes The way the universities have to use funds is kind of weird too.
Well, yeah, and it's not really a fund thing. It's you know the university brings in their visiting writers, and they could just, you know, schedule that writer's reading at the store. And they do. They have started doing this a bit more. They'll have Watermark come out to campus and sell books at a reading, and occasionally the MFA students will have their end of semester readings at the store, or they'll do it on campus. Sometimes it just depends on who's involved and what they're doing. And the most senior member of the MFA faculty there, Albert Goldbarth, he's had a relationship with the store since it started in the 70s, and I don't know quite why. That hasn't led to a more fruitful or vibrant integration of the MFA program into the community here in Wichita, because they're very insular at times, you know. And yeah, that's the thing. You know, there's a lot of activity, it seems, down here, but none of it really seems connected. There's no one person that everybody seems willing to kind of rally behind and pay attention to, what, you know. I don't know. Maybe it's too many people with personalities kind of like mine, where it's abrasive. What have you stumbled across lately since the that bookstore incident, as far as things in the community?
There's a series I've been. Well, I was, at first it kind of came through researching a poet, Ashley Jones, who's based here, and I'm hoping to do an interview with her soon. And so I was just reading about her, and she kind of co-works with some other folks doing what's called the Nitty Gritty Magic City reading series here.
Right.
And maybe, you know, I'm not very good with social media, and so I can't help but think part of this is my fault, but, you know, work and kids, I'm also not, you know, I don't go out. It's just not part of it. I mean, if I had something like that planned, it would be fine. So I at least know of that. And a friend of mine opened, I don't know what it is exactly. I haven't been able to go to it yet, but it's a kind of like a community center / venue / bookstore that is also now going to house the Alabama Zine Library.
Oh, cool.
And I know they do yoga there, and there are bi-weekly musical performances or something like that there. Uh-huh. And it's a place called the Jaybird. And
oh, cool.
It looks really cool. There's a giant mural of Walt Whitman inside. I just haven't been able to go over there and check it out, but I think he's either working with Disco, which is the one group that houses the other reading series I mentioned, he's either working with them to help with that, or he's going to start doing his own something of that nature. So there are things like since that, and you know, whenever I went there and kind of asked around about it, I've seen a few things pop up. So
I often wonder why people are so cagey about that around here. Maybe they were cagey like that when I was in graduate school out in Boulder too. I don't know.
I think sometimes there's that territorialness. I mean, one, there's the element that lots of writers are not necessarily
socially graceful.
Exactly. And so there are elements of that. And then all of us have to fight, you know, some amount of, there's also jealousy and greed and anger and all that stuff that goes into if someone's getting particular attention. There's the, you know, also the, you know, I guess there's maybe the sense too that publicly you give up, you can't hide behind, you know, certain aspects of social media or your writing if you're in person.
Right.
It seems like sometimes that's an element. There's the element of, you know, maybe feeling like you haven't read something you were supposed to, like, you know, and writers are going to be probably beating themselves up, and, you know, so there's that anxiety about those kind of things rather than just trying to enjoy,
right,
you know, people who have some, you know, they can have different interests and want to do different things, but, you know, or you know, digging in the same ditch, I guess.
Right.
You know, I think there are a lot of reasons for that.
Yeah, I definitely think there's a certain amount of defensiveness and insecurity that's at play at it. I think even here in Wichita with what seems to be a little bit more activity than what you have in Birmingham, but maybe not. You know, I've been for about a year in January, have been leading this writers group through the meetup.com app.
Oh, really?
And it's been, you know, I have a co-host, a co-sponsor, organizer that I've become friends with, and we both are of the opinion that we don't want to turn this group into a critique group, because, you know, that, especially when you have a lot of people that don't have experience with workshopping and being edited and critiqued, it gets mean.
Mm-hmm.
Because people don't know how to not take it personally. And we don't want to turn it into a seminar thing, because what I've found is that once you get that insecure self-published writer in there, then it just turns into this defensive pissing contest about which is better, self-publishing or traditional publishing. And it's like, dude,
the answer today is just both. I mean, there are plenty of writers right now who Chuck Wendig, who's writing the Star Wars novels, self-publishes stuff. It's just, you know, I mean, it's just the terrain's a little different, you know?
Yeah. And it's self-publishing is not right for everybody. Traditional publishing is not right for everybody. And, you know, when we have had self-published writers show up to our event, it really turns, it's been kind of strange. You know, I sit back and just listen and let it go. I don't have any investment in arguing about self-publishing, but I don't want to turn every meeting into, you know, discussions of what your marketing plan is or how you should behave in online book review forums and what weird opportunity to get a booth and push your book at like the Renaissance Fair is happening next. It's like,
we mentioned this, you know, this reminds me of some of what we talked about in the second episode. Uh-huh. The kind of, I think we were referring to, well, the kind of creative industry, like the notion of, or industry of creativity.
Right.
And it kind of goes along with that where, you know, they'll send out all this stuff about marketing and your I can't even use the terminology because it just makes me, want to punch myself in the face.
Right. Over and over again. It just makes you tired.
All that stuff about, and it's all, all that marketability stuff.
Your platform.
Exactly. Your platform and how you use this and all the little tricks and whatnot for all of that. But none of that has anything to do with writing. It doesn't. Yeah. If you're invested in that, you've got to be aware of the other stuff and you've got to deal with it as it comes up. But if you don't have anything written and you're not worried about getting anything done well, then none of that other stuff matters.
Right.
I don't know.
All we wanted to do with the group was to offer a space where writers could meet other writers and, maybe find some people that were doing stuff similar to what you were doing. And then you could go off and do your own group if you wanted to do a critique group. If you wanted to talk about this other stuff, that would be great. But this would be a centralized spot where you just come and you talk and realize, oh, there's a writer. There's another writer. That's a writer. That's a writer. That person I saw down the street the other day, suddenly they showed up. Oh, that's a writer. And chat. And
it's true because there's an element. I mean, I like that idea. I like that element of it because I don't always know what I can line edit, but I'm not always going to be the best one to critique, say a young adult novel or a fantasy novel or sci-fi novel or something.
Yep.
It's not that I don't like those genres, but I just don't read them enough to where I would feel, I could talk about basic writerly stuff or story interest stuff, but there may be things with that I just wouldn't get.
And I don't want to have to manage and negotiate and play a mediator in a critique group where, one person is writing historical fiction, another person's writing science fiction, another person's writing children's books, and everybody's, I don't understand it. I don't get it. I don't know what's going on. It should be useful to people. And if you're just trying to find out who the writers are in a community, just get together and have coffee and, occasionally talk about stuff. And if that means you have to sit there and just be silent while another conversation is, dancing around there, cool, do it. I mean, most of the early meetings of the group, I just sat back and, gave my little spiel about who I was and what I was doing and just let the everybody else talk. And, pretty much now, after almost a year, the group's whittled down to about four core people. We'll occasionally get somebody new that shows up, but I think sometimes people join it for a more of a romantic notion. And when you ask the questions like, well, what are you reading? Who are your favorite writers? And you get these blank responses. It's like, so why did you want to write? It's that awful situation where you've got someone who says they're a poet and they don't read poetry. And you're like, oh my God, I don't want to read that. That's going to be awful.
I won't say too much about one of the things that I've been looking at to edit, and I plan on helping this person with it, but I don't know if they realize the amount of work. This thing's like 300 pages, and there's good stuff there, but a paragraph started with a comma. And what I'm going to have to relay to the person is that there's at least two more drafts that you'll have to do on your own to find the kernel of this thing.
Right.
Some of those kind of basic aspects before, the other route is you really pay someone for content editing that's going to be really expensive. Given the state of this, but I don't know if they, the thing is, I feel for them. It's really awesome that they have what they have. I just don't know if they, I don't know if they know, like, you know, they're, what's next, you know?
Right, right.
I don't know if they get it. But I, you know, I was doing what I could, and you know, when you come across paragraphs that start with a comma,
right.
I just had to. It's like, okay, I don't know how much more I can do with this.
And, was it, you know. Could it have been just a typo or something? Like they cut something out and it got left behind?
I don't know. I mean, there were.
So everything else was so uneven that was like.
There are no paragraphs.
Maybe it was a mistake.
For different speakers. They're just all in a paragraph together.
Right.
Just some basic stuff like that.
Oh, okay.
Almost like this was what it felt like is elements of this were not too far from an initially typed draft.
Right, right.
And I can't, that has to be revised. It's not at a time for editing. Like it needs to be revised. And I'm going to try to explain that and say that I'll help them. But there's a lot of work that has to be done before someone can edit it, or they've got to be willing to pay a lot of money to someone to like do some kind of content editing.
Right, right. Yeah, we've kind of drifted into our second topic, which is good. Yeah. The editing of other people's work. I mean, that's something that inevitably is going to happen. You know, the more experienced of a writer you are when you're building a community, you're going to get asked by younger writers or newer writers, beginning writers, novice writers, you know, to take a look at their work. And, you know, so how do you, well, for instance, I'm editing my co-organizer's novel right now. And I've done a few other things for friends from graduate school and people here and there where I've looked at their manuscripts. So how did you meet this person? Was it someone you've known, or was this some other kind of solicitation that wandered this strange manuscript into your wheelhouse here?
This is someone I work with, so it was through that, and I think it was just, you know, asking about English teachers who had experience with it or would be willing to look at it, and yeah, so I was willing to do it. And still am. It's just there's a lot of work that has to be done on the manuscript itself before, because we're teachers, we don't have a lot of money. And I was charging probably less than 50% of what I would for doing something like that. And it's just where it is at this point. I can't edit it, you know.
Yeah.
And I look at I enjoy the process of it. I really do. I edit Eric's stuff a lot, and I edit other things that are kind of sent to me, and I really enjoy it. We don't have a creative writing class. We don't have any kind of creative writing classes. And over the years, I've started up various clubs and worked with students with that. And I've had a few win awards and stuff.
And
usually they're kids who really take it seriously and also take what you tell them seriously.
Right.
They're like, oh, okay, I see why, you know, and they're thoughtful about it and think about it. They're not just, they don't just, you know, think that they're going to publish Aragon or Harry Potter, which is the tends to be the thing, is like everyone has these chunky novels or, you know, a trilogy. They're planning a trilogy and they haven't written the first book yet.
Right.
And,
Have you found this useful or informative of for your own work as a practice? I mean, does it reveal anything, the editing of other people's work, about your own writing? Do you find?
I think if anything, there's a certain sense of that there's very little that, I mean, I've been writing since high school, and I was flipping through something and I had won a Stephen King award in high school, some sort of Stephen King,
right?
You know, for fiction, which I don't really do much. And there's just not a lot, I guess there's not a lot positive that you can point to and go, hey, here's this stuff about being a writer. But I guess what it allows me to do is whenever I look at that writing, and I mean this in a good way, is that you can see that, oh, you can see where you were at different points, and it does let you know that you know something about this. And I don't mean that in like a prideful way, or it's just like, oh yeah, you know, I've seen enough of this to know like what we're, and so in that sense, it makes me happy for, you know, the amount of time that I've put into the work. I don't know if it helps me. I mean, I don't know if there are a lot of other things. It at least keeps me in touch with some of the basics of it.
Right. Like, yeah.
That's, you know, practicing certain basic things of it.
That's what I've kind of have found, you know, when I've been, particularly with my co-organizer's novel, I find that by going in and editing, particularly a beginner's work, it's reconnecting me to a lot of the basics that I have stopped thinking about and just kind of take for granted when I do sit down to write. And because I'm not in a classroom anymore, because I'm not teaching, I find that it's incredibly helpful to at least, you know, reconnect with that basic knowledge. One of the problems that I've noticed in this, while editing this novel, is kind of what you want to call the architecture and the geography of space when you're writing prose. You know, where a character enters a room and what they notice first and where they stand, where furniture is, how they move through space. That's, you know, when you do that a lot, when you've practiced, when you write a lot, and you kind of understand how to move a character through an imaginary space so that the reader understands, you know, there's a chair over here and a table over there and a window and all this other stuff, you know how to do that. And when somebody doesn't quite grasp it and you find, you know, them, like suddenly they put in a piece of narrative where a character stands up and you go, when did you sit down? Right? Or, you know, they do a good job of walking the character up to an elevator door and pressing the call button and stepping inside the elevator and pressing a button for the floor, but they don't bother at all to tell you how the character gets off the elevator. They just put him in the middle of the floor they get to. And you're like, how did teleportation? You know, and that's being able to articulate how that, I guess you'd call it that connective tissue between minor traveling transitions, I guess is what you want to call it. Mm-hmm. Getting a character from point A to point B without doing the whole journalistic how-to step-by-step to ride an elevator, but making sure that you have almost cinematically the right kind of transition in place, which could just be a phrase here and there, to, you know, let the reader's imagination get them onto the elevator and off the elevator without throwing them out of the story. Mm-hmm. To go, where am I? And, you know, so it's that kind of, and I think, you know, if you do it a lot and you do begin to take it for granted and you don't do a lot of editing of other work or you don't pay attention to it, you run the risk of losing that muscle in a certain way. You know how to get around it. You can avoid that pitfall as a practiced writer, but it's a skill that can be lost. Maybe I'm just talking out my ass on that. I don't know. because it certainly made me think a lot about it more. Also, you know, selecting your point of view or your focalizing character was something that I hadn't really thought about a lot since graduate school. You know, because for me, it's kind of second nature. I just kind of stumble into, well, it feels like I stumble into it. I probably do a whole lot more pre-writing before I actually sit down to write a story, which lets me figure out which character I want to follow, which one has the right story to tell. You know, so it's, you know, when I was first asked, when I made my first comments about some of the pages I had read, she'd asked me, you know, how do you pick your point of view character? And I didn't have a good answer right away, you know? And that was totally a result of not having been in the classroom and talked about it and relying on my own intuition and ritual to get me to the right character, where I hadn't consciously had to think about, well, how do I choose my main character or my focalized character?
I've heard many fiction writers say that they listen for a particular voice that, and that voice is the one that ends up taking over.
Yep.
either leads or kind of takes over a manuscript in some way. And some can't get started unless they have that. You know, they may have some ideas, even some outlining, but then they really don't know where to go until they find that kind of voice, that mechanism that, that kind of switches on.
Yeah. And I think that's, you hear that a lot from people that tend to just have one focalizing character or two, and they've got that simple thing. And I like a cast of thousands, you know, at least two or three that I filter it through. But there's always one who's the primary controller. And if you do have those type of multiple characters, you know, that occasionally the story gets focalized through, picking the right one for a particular scene can be a bit of a challenge if you don't actually have a few questions and things in mind, like, you know, who needs to find out something right now and who has the most to gain or lose at this particular moment. So, you know, if you say, for instance, have a character who has amnesia, well, that's got to be your grounding character. That's got to be your central one. And when the goal of a scene is to reveal something about that character's forgotten past to that character, then your focalizing person has to be that amnesiac and not, you know, someone else who already knows the past secret.
Right.
Because then it's like, that would have been a short scene, you know. Person with knowledge walks in and goes, hey, you used to be, you know, an animal. You drank and farted all the time and then walk out of the room and that's all you need to do. But it's much more dramatic, much more tension. There's much more story and interest when that amnesiac is trying, is discovering, you know, layer by layer that they used to be this beer drinking animal. Right.
It reminds me of the exposition scenes that always kind of make me laugh in TV shows where, you know, you have the two experts, like the two blood experts, you know, and the detective ones, and they're sitting and telling each other, you know, what it is they're doing.
Oh, yes.
Like, I would, you see that in all kinds of stuff, you know, just a way of, just an aspect of exposition, but it always cracks me up. You see two experts sitting next to each other, even when it's like, if they're a crime lab person and, you know, this is what they do every day, supposedly. Like, why are they?
Why are they discussing, you know, how to fill a pipette, you know, right?
But then you have, you know, sometimes where you have the detective who's, you know, plays our role. You know, you know, what are you doing?
Right.
What you do with the juju into the juju bind?
Well, that's the whole point behind the detective is, you know, that's the other thing you've got to pay attention to, particularly if you're, if you're writing genre fiction, is who or what is your grounding element? What is it that the reader is holding on to and relating to? And that's the other thing driving. If you've got, you know, like with this novel that I'm editing here, if you've got a character who has amnesia, particularly in science fiction or fantasy, well, that's right there. That's your grounding character, because as they're discovering the world, they're rebuilding the world. Well, that's, you're building it for the audience
for
the
audience.
Same time.
Yeah. You have to have,
you know, that doesn't mean you can't do a story from the other end of it, but the focus and the purpose of that story has to be different than what the amnesiac is going through. You know, the story then has to be about how the person that understands the whole story copes with having to be that teacher and educator. And that's a much more difficult, you know, way to channel that story than to follow the amnesiac. And I think if you're a beginner and you're following the amnesiac, then that's where you got to go. That's where you got to stick and not try and do that nifty, complicated, you know, regarding Henry kind of storyline, which that movie was all totally from the point of view of the wife and the family having to, you know, re-educate this guy who has forgotten everything, you know, because of massive head trauma. So
yeah, been a while since I've seen that one.
Right. Whereas, you know, if you're focalizing through the amnesiac character, it's much more, what was that movie where, the guy tattooed clues on his arm?
Memento?
Yes. Yeah, that's just all the stuff I've been able to, you know, makes me want to pull out, you know, narrative discourse again, and Wayne Boots the rhetoric of fiction, and try to reapply all that specific terminology to the stuff that I know and kind of approach intuitively now more than consciously and analytically.
Mm-hmm. I like to go back. I've found a lot of that enriching. Even I like to go back and look at just grammar. I just find myself interested in grammar in a different way. Not that it always... I guess that's what you solve other problems, and then you come back and I don't know. Right. I guess you just solve those different problems as you're ready for them and kind of expand. Mm-hmm. I've had to force myself not only for that, but just other things in my reading list. I've tried to put in at least a couple things that I've already read in order to kind of reread them to make myself reread.
Right.
And it's really it's fantastic, but there's that fight, you know, because of just new stuff that, you know, there's always, if you like to read, there's just the list never ends.
Yeah.
And, but I've found a lot of, cause now I'm old enough to where I don't even remember a lot of the stuff that I read. It's, you know, going way back, you know what I mean? Like there's
right.
tons of stuff that I just don't even remember. And it's a interesting, I don't know. It's, I guess, interesting for me. I don't know how interesting it is for others, but it's fulfilling in a way.
Right.
It's enriching.
Has any of that, I'm going to segue to our next topic. Let's engage in a few speech acts here. Yeah. Has that led you to reconsidering any of your previous work that is not good, your worst work, your failed attempts? Has right
has what has like
well
I'm
editing
sorry.
And editing and relearning and going back and refreshing yourself on the basics, has that made you want to go back and attack, you know, those failed works and try and fix them?
I don't know if it's come through that exactly. I don't know. I do have that particular group of work that I think I've figured out how to deal with them, and it'll be a manuscript that will now be rewritten in some way for maybe the fifth time.
Right.
And I'm hoping it will be better. I don't know if doing the editing and doing that kind of stuff has helped with it. I don't know if there's any kind of direct aspect to it. It's more of figuring out a way into these poems in particular. Mm-hmm. I think part of it was this was a first time of consciously attempting to write a large group of poems,
right,
that weren't necessarily connect. Well, they were connected structurally, but not thematically.
This was your 100 word poems,
right? And I wrote over 100. There were 100 and something by the time I was done. And one of them will be published soon.
Oh, cool.
That's it. And the rest have marked up this amazing amount of rejections.
Hold on. I've got a cat tragedy here. Hold on just a second.
Okay. Thought I'd refresh my coffee. Let's see if I can ramble back onto that. We haven't talked about that project at all, really, have we?
About the 100 word project?
What?
Right. Well, I think we did in one of the previous episodes, but let's refresh just to keep looped in.
The initial project for that was just thinking about a larger manuscript, but it was unified initially, just this formally, structurally. And I wanted to do something, I wanted to write in a way that was experimental for me, not really necessarily experimental in that I wasn't using capitalization or punctuation, and there was a lot of language play And part of whenever I was writing this, it was just, it was the police shootings. A friend of mine was shot. I used to play in a band with. There were all these things going on. And so it was kind of there was a lot of politics in it, which I don't normally write about. There was a lot of personal history that is normally, is sometimes there, but only vaguely, or kind of shrouded surreally and things. And then there was just a lot of, I just kind of tried to open up and just have it be as playful and use a lot of wordplay. Mm-hmm. And the response hasn't been great. One person did say that some of them reading it reminded them of rap, which I thought was fine. There was a lot of kind of popular, not really popular culture. I did make a lot of references, but they were, I don't know, kind of masks and wordplay and stuff. But sending those out and also having other, some friends read them, I just noticed, I guess you have to make a decision with that is, do they just not get it? Or is it just really that the experiment failed, that what I spent all this time on, did it just not work? And it took me a while to figure out that I think the experiment failed. That it didn't work. And so and it went through a variety of phases. And ultimately what came of that is I have right now at least 3 chapbook manuscripts, and one of them is basically finished. I'm going to be sending that out here soon, probably this week. The other one I'm going to try to organize. I don't know where it's at yet. I don't know how many. The first one's all prose poems. The second one is a variety of forms, and they're poems that I've been writing over quite a while. And then I have another set that it's going to take me a long time to finish. I finally got some of those published, but they're very experimental, based on the letters of the alphabet, and they take a long time to write. It's not anything that I can just work out. And they use a variety of forms on the page, and some people would read them and wouldn't even consider them a poem. So there'll be 26 when those are done, whenever that will be. And that will be another manuscript, but I don't know when that'll be done. And then I finally, I think, cracked the code on the 100 word poems. It was really depressing to work through that at least 4 or 5 times and realize that it just wasn't successful.
Right.
And so I think that's whenever I was looking for all these other, I just distracting myself, because I knew there was like this funk of wanting to get that out, but then also thinking like, all this work. And the thing with it now is through working, I just kept writing. I've been writing probably more now than ever. I don't know what the things are. It's just a lot of stuff that I'm going to have to sit and organize. But if that itself finally crossed up with some of the pieces of the things that I was doing through that. So I'll probably go through that manuscript again, call out those particular things that are good lines, basically. They're meaningful, interesting associations, and begin pulling those out and using those as the starting point for a new set of poems that will likely be about a lot of my family, which I really haven't. They're there here and there in the work, but I haven't approached that in the way that those poems were. But yeah, they didn't seem to be, something about them just doesn't work for other people. There just hasn't worked. So that's, that next draft of those now will be, I've got to go back and restart with those. But I think part of it that was so depressing was like getting this whole manuscript done and then just like, thinking like, oh, I gotta start from zero. But it's not really that. It means that there's just less there than I start with.
Yeah. I kind of know that feeling. Yeah. I mean, I had a, I've had this, well, when I was talking with my friend Michelle about her manuscript, I had mentioned that, you know, there's, you know, just trying to encourage her and keep her going. She's finished this 80,000 word manuscript, the first one that she's finished. And, you know, there's a lot of work going on in that. And, you know, so I told her, I go, you know, I've, my first book, yeah, that's never going to see the light of day. There's, I started writing it before I went to graduate school and finished it, you know, in that first semester. And it is horrible. It's just horrible, you know, and it's, but you have to kind of go through that phase, I guess. You have to have something mm-hmm. fail.
Every fiction, the thing is I hear that more with fiction writers. George Saunders has a really funny story about his first yeah. novel and, like kind of sneaking glances at his wife reading it and her like holding her head in her hands.
Right.
And, you know, his whole thing was like, you know, this, I got this baby, don't worry. You know, I'm going to sell this novel. And yeah, I mean, he's done, and he trashed right. that one. And it's like, that one will not see the light of day. And I guess I just haven't heard, and maybe I haven't noticed it, I haven't read as many poets grapple yeah. with that to a certain yeah. degree. And this was my first time really trying to write in a larger, like pieces being to get, because most of the time for writing poetry for me is one line right. at a time. And it's a different animal than the large scales, like thinking of a something longer like that. And yeah, it yeah. wasn't good.
Well, yeah. And sometimes you have more than one failure that,
oh, yeah.
that sandwich a success. I managed The Evolution of Shadows. And after, you know, my first failed novel that's never going to see the light of day. And then after Shadows, I wrote a third one that I thought, yeah. And it, you know, it turns out that one was a failure too.
And how much did you write for that one? How long was that one?
That one was about 300 some pages. That one was called By the Still, Still Water. Oh, it was finished. It was revised multiple times and read out loud and all that stuff and sent to my editor and it was you know, this is this would not be a good follow-up for it. You might want to just put this aside and work on something else. And I was like, I'll show you.
Oh, God.
And started revising it again and got about you know, halfway or two-thirds of the way through it and was looking at a page one day and went, oh, there it is. Yeah, he's right. Just put this in the...
Man, how was that, though? I mean, it was brutal,
well, yeah,
wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean...
Yeah, it's... But I think...
I'd spent a good, you know, 2 or 3 years working on...
Yeah.
On this, my Korea book, and had to...
But this isn't part of what you hear all the time with the, you know, creativity marketing and you know... All that kind of stuff. But this is I think this is what, you know, people have to be prepared for.
Yeah.
Most people are not in the place of someone like Neil Gaiman. It just comes to mind where like he comes out with something and most people are going to go, oh,
yeah.
You know, and, you know, most people aren't in that mm-hmm. position. Not saying, I don't know. I haven't read much of him. I'm just saying he seems well loved, probably very reasonably by right. most people, you know, well liked, well loved.
Yeah, but we don't know what he's got socked away in a drawer in the desk that
sure,
nobody's
yeah.
ever going to see.
Exactly. And he's probably talked about it, but I don't know enough. I mean, George Saunders is one. Lincoln and the Bardo won.
The Man Booker.
What all did
yeah.
it win? You know, he's done. What he did, he won several yep. other awards with the short story collections and all that. But I mean, you know, he didn't, I mean, he kind of made it funny,
right?
You know, that he wrote this book and pulled it and tucked it away. And it is funny and to a certain degree. Right. But there's also that element of, it was depressing yeah. to do all that work and realize that it's not work, yep. you know, it's not working as it is. It was really hard.
Yeah. I think that's the measure of, I don't know, I guess a writer's determination or their, or it's evidence that they've chosen the right path. If they can fail, and fuck it, do it again.
Yeah, it was good. I realized later, meaning weeks, months right. later, after this kind of, you know, I realized later that it was okay, right. that it wasn't so bad, that it was, you know, there are positive things to get mm-hmm. from it, but man, it was not like, I haven't been, I wouldn't say successful. I mean, in the way that success is measured right. generally in our,
at least in American letters. But, yeah.
Right. But since I've been a kid in high school, most things that I've written and that have been serious about and made it to the point to where I wanted to send them out, I've done pretty right. well getting stuff out. And it's not that I've got notebooks and I mean, that's the thing. I write a lot and there isn't, you know, the stuff that I send out is stuff that it takes a while to mm-hmm. to get. So, you know, there is that, but this was the first thing where I had spent all that work and it was it didn't work, you know. It was like it was that kind of failure where it was right. and it, you know, it throws you yeah. off, you know, it threw me off. It was really
yeah.
tough.
Yeah, I guess I was somewhat fortunate, you know, in graduate school, they my advisor Bobby Louise Hawkins and a lot of my other instructors, you know, we're pretty adamant about telling us, you've got a lot of bad words to get out of your system, and it's best just to sit down and write them out. You know, there's no shortcut. Mm-hmm. You know, and about the same time, or maybe a little bit after that, was when Malcolm Gladwell came out with, you know, all that stuff about, you know, so many hours to become an expert or
yeah,
whatever.
The outliers.
And
which there's a lot of debate about that right now.
Yeah.
I've read a lot of stuff countering. I don't know it well enough to really speak on yeah. it, but there is something to that idea, though. I think,
and you know, definitely. I was getting that advice pre Gladwell from people that mm-hmm. you know knew and worked with, you know, Kerouac and Ginsberg and Burroughs, whose whole philosophy was to make writing like jazz, and the only way you do that is by constantly practicing, mm-hmm. and that's the only way you can make this idea, or at least present the notion, even if it's an illusion of spontaneous writing or spontaneous brilliance, is if you put in the hours and the time and you figure out, you know, what a good rhythm is, what a good storyline is, and how to put that down as quickly as possible. You don't do that if you don't practice, if you don't practice, you know, form even, mm-hmm. you know, you got to put in the hours. And that's, and so, yeah, if you're doing that, then you're going to fail a lot. And yeah, I'm always kind of shocked when, you know, well, there was a gentleman that came to our group a couple of times, and, you know, he's talking a big game about all these ideas and all this research he was doing for this novel. And I go, well, are you writing anything? No, I haven't really started writing anything yet. And I was like, well, when you're done doing your research and you sit down to write, you're going to stare at the blank page and not do anything. You need to practice. You need to get the bad words out of your system. You need to establish that habit of when you sit down to write, you're ready to write. You're ready to put those words down, even if they don't mean anything, even if they don't go anywhere. Just get in the habit of tapping out words. So if you're serious about, you know, wanting to write this epic fantasy novel you've got in your head, I don't care what you write about. Just sit down, find out what your habit and your ritual is, and write. Write an essay. You know, write some research. You know, and you know, that was kind of a shockingly new revelation to him. And I was, well, you know, this is why you get out and talk to other writers.
My, we called him Aunt Eric, but wasn't related to the family in any way. on my wife's side, he had worked as a rocket scientist for NASA and stuff. And he had he was telling everybody that he was working on this book or series of books that I think had a blending. It was some sort of medieval or Renaissance world right. that may have had some sort of technology embedded in it. And he could sit and tell you for hours about this world, you know, building right. this world and everything. And after we died, like, there was, he had written nothing.
Oh, wow.
He had done all this research and he had, you know, formulated all this stuff in his head, but he had done none of the writing right. for it, none of it at all. And had, you know, everything was very elaborate. Mm-hmm. I have plenty of students who, in the past I have, I don't right now because I don't have time to do creative writing clubs mm-hmm. and everything. I have more students than ever. I have more other duties and jobs to do than ever. And one of the things that I've had to let go is like all that right. extra stuff that I've to do. In the past, I've done film clubs. I've done philosophy clubs. I've done all that. But with kids and everything, I just, there are things I'd like to do, you know, with and for students, but I just can't do right. them now. And as long as someone brings me something, I'll look at it at school, but I can't, unless we have classes for creative writing, I can't do it. But what that, a class like that, what it would do is what I would hope is it would get them in the mindset of, you know, ideas are great, but the thing is, everyone has ideas. We all have ideas. I have a ton of novel ideas. I have a ton of movie script ideas. I have a ton of ideas for poems or sequences of poems. But the thing that matters is like, what do you get on mm-hmm. the page? You know, what can you get on the page? And that's the hard yeah. part, the sitting down and getting that out there on the page. And that would be more of a practice. Also, it would be really, I think, helpful for those students to see the process of revision and editing mm-hmm. and drafting and that kind of thing. It's very difficult. It's always been difficult to do that in a regular class, for me right. anyway. Maybe I just haven't figured out how to teach it well, but it would definitely be an interesting aspect of a creative writing course to be able to teach that in a much mm-hmm. better way.
Do you have a 100-word poem you want to share with us from the failure?
I don't have one offhand. I can look here if there's a way you have to kill any time.
Oh, no, there was something we'd thought about doing yeah. was sharing some of our quote unquote worst work.
It's been so right. It's been so long ago that I wasn't even sure if we were going to follow that outline because of all the kind of technical problems yeah. that I've been having.
Oh, don't worry about it.
In life problems.
I still think it would be fun sometime in the future to kind of share some of our work on the show, whether it's some of the yeah, bad stuff or some of the good stuff, but we can do that at a later time.
I've got it right here. If you
yeah,
want.
Throw it at me. Let's see what we get. Let's give it a listen.
All right, let me see. So the book is when I had finished it, I called it "Here is a picture of what I eat." Just you know, Instagram and pictures of what people eat. You know, like I said, this deals with some of that okay. stuff. Let me see. All right, here's all right. I'm trying to I'll read this. This was the first one that okay. I wrote out of all of them. It's called "I Lost the Equations." I lost the equations traceable in bass solos on that record or on that other one of underwater keyboard, but wasn't Raymond Scott stroking Henson's beard, or the stray felt I or three, to who, to wit, to what sound of the head in the head, and when does the unwatched sparkle? Now bid adieu to that good night, sweet prince of the welpin, hark holpen in heroish fanscape.
Right on. That's not bad.
No, I don't think these are, you know, I mean, that one, yeah, I mean, Jim Henson worked with Raymond Scott for a while, and so there's it's just me thinking somewhat about heroes, mm-hmm. and the end has this very fake translated Anglo-Saxon mixed with some Hamlet yeah. there, and you know, just thinking about heroes and father figures right. and that kind of stuff.
Excellent. How much of this, cause I have some pages from By the Still, Still Water here with me. If you want to hear them, how much do you want to hear? Maybe, let's go with the first page and a half.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
Just by way of, it was, the story is supposed to be, take place over a family reunion at a house on a lake, supposedly in the middle of Kansas. Ben takes his lawn chair from where it leans by the door and carries it off the porch and down the dirt path to the edge of the water and out along the dock to the end. He stands for a moment, the chair propped against his thigh. The sun is not yet over the horizon, and the sound of the water against the dock is quiet now with no wind. He unfolds the chair and faces it towards the water but doesn't sit down. Carefully, he gets down on his knees, then lays out with his head over the edge and lowers his arms into the water up to his elbows, stretches out his fingers. Amused now, after so long, by his abbreviated pinkies. After a few minutes, a cluster of tiny fish swim close to his hands. At first, he tries to catch one, but knows he is too slow. As he watches them dart about, then pause close to him as if to sniff at him like curious dogs, he realizes he doesn't remember what kind of fish they are. He suspects that he knew once, a long time ago. So many memories return to him when he does this, years of debris that he wishes he could discard, but sometimes there are gems, little rubies like the thrill of holding Marie for the first time after making love, or the aching splendor of his daughter's birth. All the debris is worth the return of those dimly sparkling jewels. Today, however, there's nothing good, and he slowly takes his arm out of the water and pushes himself up to his knees and then carefully to his feet. He stands for a moment, feeling the water drip off his fingers and speckle the gray boards. Finally, he sits down and looks out at the horizon to watch the faint headlights on the highway in the distance, fading against the sunrise. When he comes inside a few hours later, there is a glass of water on the table, his pills set out on a napkin. Marie won't let him eat breakfast until he has taken them. All this fuss, and he is not the one who is truly ill. He has thought about lying, washing them down the sink, but somehow she would know. So he carefully puts one pill in his mouth at a time and swallows it with a sip of water. When he is done, he goes out of the kitchen and into the living room, where Marie is sitting on the couch reading the newspaper. She looks at him, but doesn't say anything. And that's how it started. I was always kind of, you know, happy with the detail, but, trying to center the story through a 60-year-old man when you're in your 30s is a bit of a challenge.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you throwing in maybe 7 or 8 focalizing characters throughout that story.
Oh, wow.
So there was the patriarch and his wife, the two sons and the daughter, and then another character. Yeah, 6. So 6 total, I think. How many were? Or I might have had one of the children. I don't know.
Wow.
But yeah, trying to write about the war. It was my attempt to write an anti-war book. In the days after 9/11, of course.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Well, okay, it's 12:20 now, and I have to hop on a FaceTime call with somebody at 1. So, yeah, I think that went well today.
All right.
Is there was there anything you wanted to discuss before we...
I can't think of anything in right. particular. Yeah.
Well, thanks for talking again, Stephen.
All right.